Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Is that the end of this case?
How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Start with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all next.
Welcome to episode 203 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. Three cases today. First case today is from the Illinois Appellate Court, First District, Andrews versus Carbon on 26th, LLC. The second is from the Indiana Supreme Court, Dolson Jr. versus Veolride, Inc., Suite Real Estate, City Center, LLC. And the third is from the Illinois Appellate Fourth, Rousey versus Brightman. Turning to segment one. In a matter of first impression, the Illinois Appellate Court, First District, in Aston Andrews versus Carbon on 26th LLC, whether it will, can, and should expand the exceptions to the direct notice required by 810 LCS 5/2-6073A of the Uniform Commercial Code. Allegedly E. coli contaminated cilantro caused illness in dozens of patrons at a restaurant in Chicago, and there were a slew of lawsuits. Many years after the first lawsuits, third-party claims were brought against the suppliers of the herb. The Circuit Court granted summary judgment to the suppliers, finding that notice of the defective goods was not provided timely. Section 6073A provides that, quote, where a tender has been accepted, the buyer must, within a reasonable time after he discovers or should have discovered any breach, notify the seller of breach or be barred from any remedy, end quote. In Connick v. Suzuki Motor Company, 174 Ill. 2nd, 482, the Illinois Supreme Court recognized two exceptions to the direct notice requirement. Quote, one, the seller has actual knowledge of the defect of the particular product, or two, the seller is deemed to have been reasonably notified by the filing of the buyer's complaint alleging breach of UCC warranty, end quote. The third-party plaintiff here argues for a third exception concerning perishable goods. Pat, tell us about this case.
So it's a very interesting situation here where a party, I think there were 50-some lawsuits filed or 50-some people that contracted the illness as a result of this allegedly contaminated E. coli. The E. coli was found, or there was an epidemiological survey done by the Chicago Department of Health that found that there was, the cilantro was the likely cause of this of these illnesses at this restaurant, so the restaurant gets sued, and then they a couple of years after this incident, they didn't find the salon, you know, the source of the contamination for many months, and then apparently never told the suppliers. There's multiple suppliers that they then sue as third-party defendants, like 6 years after this incident that occurred, I think in like 2016 or something, or sorry, 2018, and then they sue them many years later. And the question is were the original lawsuits that were filed, did that against these suppliers, were those notice? And I think the answer is no, because that wasn't raised below. And so then the question becomes, were the third-party complaints that were filed even more for 6 years later? I'm struggling with the statute of limitations on that, but I think what it is, I'm not sure. I don't get the statute of limitations. I don't understand why you typically need to file third-party complaints or contribution within 2 years of the date of service. So but that isn't the issue. So put that issue aside. Whether that constituted notice. And the argument is from the third-party defendants is, how are we supposed to defend this when whatever evidence or indicia that the contamination came from our farm, long since gone, but even at the time that it was gone, or even though at the time that it was discovered, which took a while to figure out whether it was a cilantro or the lettuce or the beef or the this or the that. I mean, you know, in a restaurant, tons of items it could have come from. And the CP or the Chicago Department of Health comes up with it's the cilantro, and they had gotten the cilantro from a number of different farms through a supplier. So there's a supplier, and then there's a wholesaler, and then this wholesaler gets it from a number of farms. So they don't know which sets of the farms it actually came from. It takes so long to figure out where even the source, never mind tracking it back to which lot of the cilantro was delivered on this date that would have been the correct. So you find the right farm. Maybe you can then track down to the field that it came from and figure, but all by the time you figure all that out, it seems that you're long past the ability to investigate and defend. So what the defendant third party plaintiff is asking for is an additional exception to the rule established in Connick that the seller has actual knowledge of the event. They didn't in this case. That's not what happened. They didn't know they were shipping E. coli contaminated cilantro. So that isn't on the menu. And then the seller is deemed to have reasonably notified by the filing of the buyer's complaint alleging. So that really isn't the issue because we've got the complaints were filed a couple years later by the persons who were injured by the contamination. And so they want this other exception. Well, we get an extra time because of the perishable nature of these goods. You know, the UCC, the sales section, Article 2 of the UCC, deals with, as my contracts professor described it, anything you can put on a truck. A good is anything you can put on a truck. So it's distinct from securities. It's distinct from commercial paper. It's distinct from money. It's just, you know, all these, those are not goods. You can't put them on a truck. That was his way to kind of boil down the definition of what it is. Well, cilantro plainly can be on a truck. Probably was in this case. So therefore it's a good, it's governed by the Uniform Commercial Code. And as we all know, the Uniform Commercial Code is not so uniform, both in its drafting, by the individual states, as well as its interpretation, but the ideas for it to be, it's a very good thing. But it's not necessarily uniform. There's no state that I think that they weren't pointing to other states that had come up with this exception. This certainly can't be the first circumstance where contaminated perishable goods, be it food or something else, that's perishable, although food is the quintessential perishable good. All things can be put on trucks. It doesn't seem there's any other case that's come up with this theory of this delay. I doubt the court's going to find it here. And I think, as Justice Mikva said, is it really our role to do this? This is plainly something that if it's going to be done, it needs to be done by the Supreme Court. It's not our role to do this. And I'm not sure how convincing making this rule is in any event. The food shouldn't be contaminated with E. coli, but I think you've got to encourage buyers to find out problems work as quickly as they can, and give actual notice as quickly as they can so that problems can be identified and corrected. I think the fact that it's perishable makes the statute, makes you wanting to provide notice even sooner than giving some sort of leeway to waiting. That makes it impossible, difficult if not impossible, to defend the matter. Dan, what are your thoughts?
The same thoughts, Pat, and I think that, you know, it's an interesting theory that they've brought up and another exception, but I agree with you. I think Justice Mikva has it right. The Supreme Court have to do this, and honestly, I don't think the Supreme Court would be inclined to do this. I think it's...
You're going to take the case.
Right. Nah, I don't either. And you know, I think, like you said, I think with perishable, you'd want to give notice even quicker, right? Because it is perishable. So the evidence goes away and it's hard to take steps to do anything once it's gone. So,
right. Exactly. Or defend yourself.
Yeah. And again,
whatever damage has been done.
Right.
If you don't want it to happen again, you can't.
And unfortunate cases, but yeah, I don't see this one happening.
Yeah, I don't, and it's going to leave the restaurant holding the bag, but you don't cook cilantro usually, at least not. I mean, it's, all right, I suppose you do, but in when you put it as a topping or whatever, it doesn't get cooked. The E. coli, if it's there, you
right.
The E. coli comes as a bonus. Enjoy. It's not what you want. So.
No.
With that, we'll take our break, first break, and come back with Dolson versus Vioride.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome back to segment two of episode 203 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. And will the Indiana Supreme Court modify the firefighters rule? That is the question to be answered when the court considers Dolson versus Vioride Inc. Suite Real Estate City Center LLC. The court summarized the case thusly. Dolson sued Vioride and Suite Real Estate for injuries he suffered while fighting a fire at the defendant's property. The Allen Superior Court granted the defendant's motion for summary judgment, finding the firefighters rule barred recovery. The Court of Appeals reversed, finding genuine issues of material fact precluded summary judgment. Vioride has filed a petition to transfer and asked the Supreme Court to assume jurisdiction. So transfer is the first issue. The Defense Trial Counsel of Indiana filed an amicus brief, and I'm a member of the amicus committee, though I wasn't involved in the drafting of this particular matter, briefing on this matter. And there was argument by DTCI representative at the oral argument, as often happens in the Indiana Supreme Court, which is somewhat unusual to allow as much argument by amicus as occurs in the Indiana Supreme Court case we're going to talk about later. Had five people arguing,
yeah,
two of which were amici, and one of them, amici, went first. Very strange. Not here, but that's the case we're going to talk about in our third segment, Cosby. Dan, tell us about the case.
Thanks, Pat. And so the firefighter's rule is it allows no claim by a professional emergency responder for the negligence that creates the emergency to which he or she responds. And there's a lot of talk at the by the Chief Justice, especially about toys left on the floor in someone's house. And
watch out for them Legos.
Legos or other toys of our grandkids that were be left. There's talk about stairs leading down the basement. In this case, there was an unfinished wall that was near some pit in this warehouse. It was dark. There was testimony and argument that this room is always dark, has no windows, has very poor lighting. And what happened was this firefighter fell through this hole in the wall. There was smoke and darkness. And as you mentioned, Pat, the thing about the Indiana Supreme Court, we've had cases on here where transfers granted. So when transfers granted, the appellate court case is voided and invalidated. In this case, transfer was not granted. And unlike some of the cases we've covered in the past, they actually both argued why transfer should be granted. This law or this rule in Indiana, and it's a similar rule in many, many jurisdictions. And again, to think about the reasoning for it, it's designed so that people don't have to take fear or worry about bringing emergency responders to their place of business or home because of, you know, like I said, the dishes are undone, the chairs are out from the table. There's Legos on the floor. You don't want to have a situation where these folks are invited to your place to put out a fire and put out and help save you, and then they slip and fall on something or get injured because of some open and apparent danger. A lot of interesting discussion here. The appellant got a lot of questions from the Chief Justice out of the gate. I think she was very active, and then her colleagues joined in at some point and asked questions of the appellant counsel. The goal here from what it sounds like from the appellee and from the description of the case, Pat, is that they want to expand expand the rule, and the exception, according to the appellant, would then become swallow the rule. But this is, in Indiana at least, this rule was originally established in 1893. I think one of the interesting questions that was asked pretty early on by the Chief Justice, she talked about a study that was done, and unlike a lot of states, at least states we've talked about, Pat, the Seventh Circuit, Wisconsin, you've got Indiana, then you got Illinois. Illinois has a lot of decent-sized municipalities, not a lot of voluntary firefighters and firemen here.
You have fire protection districts, so they're all another taxing district that we have that professionalizes the firefighting service.
But in Indiana, the vast majority are actually volunteer, 73%. The Chief Justice asked about, how that played into this play. A lot of talk about things and whether things could be converted from open and obvious to latent defects, depending on circumstances. I think one of the discussions, and I think one of the things that justices are trying to consider here, and whether they take transfer, is whether the smoke, which everybody concedes it was smoke, there was smoke and darkness, and whether you could separate those two or whether those two are indistinct from each other because the smoke would have obscured things. I thought the most interesting hypothetical asked here was the venomous snake situation, where a property owner has venomous snakes on the property and asks the folks, there's a sign up that says venomous snakes on the property, do not enter at your own risk. And what happens in situations where it's smoky and dark and you can't see the sign, does that then become a latent defect? So a lot of questions and discussion during the case of that factor. A lot was made of what was actually alleged here. They only alleged smoke at first, and then they came back and talked about darkness.
That was after an inspection.
After an inspection took place, and it was determined that this space was, in fact, hard to see, like this, and no windows, very poor lighting. As you mentioned, the amicus argued, and one of their opening statements was that Indiana has taken pride in litigation efficiencies, and that there should be few exceptions that come into play for this firefighter's rule. Again, we want a situation where people are not afraid to call 911. I think the Chief Justice was skeptical that people, when their house is on fire, are making determinations that, oh my God, I haven't showered or cleaned up my kitchen or put the dishes away or the toys, or there may be things out. Probably the reality. I mean, I think, in situations where you have a fire that's starting, one of my neighbors, for example, I saw him for the first time in months, and he has been gone from his house since January. He told me late last week he had made a fire in January, and then the ashes were cool, and so he put them in the garbage pail, and then somehow those flames reignited, and his whole garage is burnt to crisp with all the oil and rubber and accelerants that you keep in your garage. And now his house is done. And, again, would he have been like, oh, well, if I didn't clean up the fire, so I'm not going to call? Probably not. Like you said, Pat, after the inspector came in, there was an affidavit that it was smoke and darkness. It was made. And there was also, I guess, a hole in the ground that the amicus talked about. That's what he fell into.
And that's what caused the injury. He couldn't see it, was the claim. And it didn't matter if there was a fire or not.
And again, the argument here is that this is accepted public policy, and that there's no duty to warn of these types of things. And so, again, It'll be interesting to see if the Indiana Supreme Court takes transfer. We've talked about it, Pat, before. It's a fairly unique process, to my knowledge, where sometimes they'll hear little arguments like this, and we have seen cases I think we've covered before where it turns out that they don't grant transfer for whatever reason. They either this is not the case to consider a change or expansion of a rule or a constriction of a rule. So it'll be interesting to watch and see what the Indiana Supreme Court does with this case.
It will be. I don't know how often this firefighter's rule comes up. I was surprised at how much plaintiff's counsel indicated that it did.
I know.
I was like, okay, there's some cases out there, but it's really not. Well, apparently it's a big deal. So I was surprised to hear that. The facts of this case are a bit unique, I would think. That could lead to the exception swallowing the rule. And I think that the rule is a good one, but
it is.
But you got to be careful not to expand the exception too large. So we'll see what happens. So with that, we'll take our next break, and we will come back and we will discuss Rousey versus Brightman. Quite the oral argument.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
We're back for segment 3 of episode 203 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. Can the failure of the trial court to allow certain damaged evidence to be presented to the jury have any impact on the appeal of a defense verdict? At the oral argument in Rousey versus Brightman, counsel for plaintiff appellant sure thought it did, but the justices on the panel of the Illinois Appellate Court, 4th District, weren't buying it. The plaintiff claimed medical malpractice resulting from a failed outpatient procedure to remove a gastric band. There were substantial complications following the surgery, including 3 additional surgeries and a hospital stay. Of the 9 claimed errors by the plaintiff, the one that seems to have the most chance of success is the claim that the trial court should not have limited the instruction on res ipsa. The plaintiff argued that the instruction should have been given more broadly, but with regards to the majority of the alleged malpractice, the plaintiff presented expert testimony of precise acts or omissions of negligence. Pat, tell us about this case.
So, Dan, I will get to the argument that might actually have some merit, but there's a lot of arguments here made by the appellant that don't have very much merit. The first one is they wanted an editor on a defense verdict. Now, I that doesn't even register. I don't even understand what that makes sense. How that makes sense for those that aren't familiar with an editor, it's the idea. It's the obverse of a remitter. So, in a case where there's a plaintiff's verdict, the defense comes in and says you should remit the value down to a certain amount. Otherwise, you should order a new trial if the plaintiff doesn't accept the remitter because the jury verdict was out of control. Okay. That's a remitter. An additor is plaintiff comes in and says the award was insufficient and you should add to the verdict, judge. And if not, give me a new trial. You can't add to a defense verdict because they didn't find any liability on the part of the defendant. So there's no editor. They didn't reach damages as the court tried to impress upon plaintiff's counsel. The jury didn't reach damages because they didn't get past either the net, duty and breach or causation. I don't know. We don't know which, under the complete judgment rule. I mean, they could have found, they had to find all the things. So, that's the first problem. Second problem was plaintiff's counsel kept saying you didn't let in this damages evidence, and this hurt my case. The court's like, well, seems the jury may have found that there was no negligence in the first instance. So what is the how did the damage hurt you? Don't you have to beat that first? Because their first argument is you didn't show that there was any negligence. And the plaintiff's saying, no, I get to bring this in. Do you have a case for that proposition? Didn't have a case for that proposition because there's no case for that proposition. You don't reach the damages until you find duty, breach, and causation. If you don't find duty, breach, and causation, damages isn't a thing. And so why do we have to reach that issue? So let's get to the issue. So the question was whether this injury to the splenic artery that caused the removal of the spleen and bleeding and big problems, DVT, all kinds of complications. No doubt there are damages here, but the big question is to whether there's duty breach and causation. Really, breach is the issue. Is could this have occurred in the absence of negligence? And the problem was, is the defense or the plaintiff's expert said what the negligence was, said what the standard of care was and how it was breached. And the defense expert said, no, it wasn't breached and that the conduct, the care was fine. This is a known complication. This can happen in the absence of negligence. Sometimes shit doesn't go well. It happens. And I may have to click the explicit comment, marking on the comment. Sometimes things don't go well. And this is one of those circumstances. And the jury seems to have bought that argument from the defense. Right, wrong, indifferent. I don't know how you make a res ipsa argument where you didn't make a res ipsa argument. If your expert said, this is what you should have done, and as a consequence, this happened, that's not res ipsa. That's, we know what you did or didn't do, and we know what caused it. We know the negligence, in other words. You can't have it both ways. These are independent theories of proof. So I don't understand. Res ipsa is not a cause of action, remember. It's a theory of proof, our method of proof. It's an evidentiary way to say, we don't know how this happened, but this consequence doesn't occur in the absence of negligence. Well, in this case, their expert said, no, I know what happened and or didn't happen. And you breached the standard of care, and therefore there was this injury. That's, you know, the jury just didn't buy it. Jury doesn't have to believe experts. They could have agreed with the defense expert. And maybe the jury was right, maybe the jury was wrong, but that's not typically a thing that gets second-guessed. That's something that usually stands, whether they find for the plaintiff or they find for the defendant, as happened here. And whether damages were properly admitted, and maybe they had, you know, as I listened to the damages arguments, I kind of think that those might have had merit, that they weren't able to admit certain damages. That seemed like they had something to talk about there. But it doesn't matter if there's a defense verdict. That's just not how the system works. You don't reach the damages. Dan, what are your thoughts?
I agree with you. And I think, again, if you're the argument can't be additive, it has to be that the jury got it wrong, right? And like you said, the remand to retry or issues of fact that exist, whatever. But I don't get this. How do you add to zero? So it's
add to zero, but zero may be because not because they didn't find any damages, because plainly there were damages presented.
There were damages presented, but again, the jury found that they weren't, the defendant wasn't liable for them.
Exactly.
Right, for whatever reason, like you said, and so just like you said, when an expert tells you something, why you don't address that, I don't know. So.
I don't understand it. A very strange handling of this case. Which brings
Indeed.
Us to our BIPA, GIPA, IPA, BI for COVID situation. And we have a case this week, but not of the usual kind.
No.
It is Fleur versus Anonymous Hospital and Doctors and Hospital from Indiana. And this is a case involving COVID-19 immunity for medical malpractice. Now, in a couple weeks, there will be an argument on May 22nd in James versus Geneva. And I'm not sure we discussed this case because I don't think I had oral argument, We may have discussed the opinion in this segment when it came out, but this is a case in Illinois. So this will be heard by the Illinois Supreme Court on May 22nd. And one of my former colleagues who argued a case we're going to talk about next week, Robert Chemers, is going to argue for the defendant's respondents in that case, that the governor's executive order that gave immunity to medical professionals and medical facilities following the COVID-19 pandemic, that gave them immunity but for willful and wanton misconduct, that that's enforceable and allowed. Similarly, Indiana didn't do it by executive order, but they did it by statute. So less problematic constitutionally from my perspective.
Right.
Although it doesn't seem that the petitioners in the James case in Illinois are making the constitutional argument that I would make. They're making different arguments. I don't think they're going to be very successful based on my understanding of them. I don't know why they aren't making the constitutional argument. Probably for they don't like them. The governor doesn't have the non-delegation principle would be the idea is that from my perspective, the General Assembly couldn't have granted the governor the authority under the Emergency Management Act to do this kind of a thing unilaterally. And they're taking the position that either he didn't, or rather that the statute didn't grant him that authority. The bottom line is that I don't think that's going to work. I think the defendants are going to win there when we get there, but we'll see. We'll see what our argument. In this case, they affirmed the holding of the trial court in Indiana that because they couldn't show willful and wanton misconduct. In fact, in this case, it was pretty clear that the decedent didn't even have COVID. So I don't understand what any of this had to do with it. He tested negative for COVID all along the way, and yet they found, well, because of COVID protocols, you didn't provide him appropriate care. It's like, what now? I'm confused. But the bottom line is that they held that you didn't show willful and wanton misconduct with respect to the treatment, and therefore this was a pre. So we've talked about in Indiana the procedure that they use for medical malpractice, and there's this panel you file this complaint with the Department of Insurance, but then you can also get pre-relief on legal issues in the circuit court, and that's what happened here. So an interesting and important case that we'll see. Presages what might happen in Illinois, but we shall see. Dan, prediction sure to go wrong this week. We were 1-0-2. The algorithm gave us a punt that we didn't actually punt on because of what the court did. So we took it as a punt. We'll talk about that. Dan is 310-63-26. I am 307-66-26. Dan, why don't you tell us about Culley versus Marshall that we discussed on episode 175?
Sure. This was the civil forfeiture case that involves the police being able to take possession of cars and other property based on stops where there's suspected bad conduct. In each of the two cases that were consolidated that went up to the Supreme Court, the cars were lent to one case, I think the son of the lady, in another case, a nephew. And when the pullovers were had, there was methamphetamines in one car and a gun. There was marijuana, I think, and some other stuff in the other car. And we've talked about these cases. The police are allowed to take these cases. The question in this case was whether or not due process required a preliminary hearing in these cases so that you could quickly come to the decision about whether the car got retained or not. Majority of the court in this case, six justices, Gorsuch did his own concurrence, suggested that while due process is due, none of the statutes and historically none of the statutes have required that there be a preliminary hearing as part of due process. Gorsuch had a very pretty striking concurrence that, if adopted, would revisit this. We've talked about qualified immunity, Pat, and whether that should be revisited. Gorsuch is suggesting, as we've talked about in these cases, including this one, that the challenge in these cases is that it becomes an abuse of the police powers when things are confiscated. We talked about the car in Indiana with the individual with the fairly new car. Yep, Sims. And so Gorsuch is suggesting that there's been so much abuse in this case, in these cases, that we ought to look at it. And there was a dissent in this case. I think Sotomayor wrote it, right? And suggested that, again, that the court went too far, that they had a very limited question here and were too expansive. So, like I said, Kavanaugh wrote the majority opinion, and five justices joined that, and then Gorsuch concurred in the result. But as he does, sometimes Thomas has done in the past, they suggest a broader revisiting of this issue on the proper case to reconsider the law. And many have speculated. Sometimes I've talked about this in my book. I've talked about it on this podcast, Pat. Sometimes a justice or two will plant a seed for a future day. This whole issue the electors case was a Rehnquist concurrence in Bush v. Gore. And so sometimes the courts, these seeds get planted for a long time, like trees, and then eventually they get revisited, and it becomes the popular law that also happened in, I believe, Citizens United, perhaps. I think it was Citizens United. There was a case in Austin, Texas, same thing, where a concurrence had some language, and then that became adapted later as the court's position on things. So an interesting case. And as we've talked about in here, it'd be nice if enough justices picked up on Gorsuch's concurrence to at least revisit and kind of consider if there's some kind of scale or some kind of better rule that could be applied in these cases.
Well, I building on that, Dan, I agree. The majority grounded its opinion on the historical practice of civil asset forfeiture and said, hey, going back to the founding and before and up into the late 20th century, there never was this need. There's never a historical precedent for these preliminary hearings, and these only began to come into practice in state law in the late 20th century. Well, it will not come as a surprise that I generally think the historical view of trying to figure out what the original public meaning of the document is a good method. The problem is we're not dealing with the establishment or the understanding of a right, whether it's the First Amendment rights or the Second Amendment or so forth. We're dealing with due process under the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment, which means it has to respond to what the government is doing that's changing. So why is it that some states felt it necessary to include a requirement for a preliminary hearing? Well, that's because, as Dan said, the cops are profiting from these asset forfeitures. They have an incentive in a way that they didn't previously to engage in this activity and, as Justice Gorsuch pointed out, as Dan mentioned, potentially abuse it. And so that brings us to the facts of this particular case. The facts in this particular case are very bad vehicles for this, because in these two cases, as Justice Kavanaugh points out in the majority written for the court, both of them waited a long time to raise this defense. And once they raised it, the state court gave them their vehicle back. But it took them months, in some cases more than a year, to raise the issue, to even get in. One of them had a default judgment entered against them, and then they got it vacated, and then came in and presented their defense, but even that took a long time. And it was during that interregnum when they filed the putative class action alleging the 1983 violation. So it's very hard in this case to say that these people, a preliminary hearing would have made a difference. They both didn't show up for a long time. If they were there on the first day saying, I'm an innocent owner, giving my car back, as is a defense under Alabama law, both these cases come out of Alabama, and this is a defense under Alabama law, well, that's a different kettle of fish. So I think you have to, the historical practice of looking at what has been done in the past has to track in the context of due process. And we're not talking about substantive due, we're talking about procedural due process. What is the procedure that we're out? You have to look at the procedure as it's been practiced. What is the government doing to you right now? And what does due process require under that circumstance, which is different than how the government has practiced it in the past? The government innovates a new practice. Does it have to provide, what kind of process does it have to provide in order to protect against it when the government conceives of a new process? That's what's, see, you got to compare apples to apples.
Right.
Yes, civil assets forfeiture has existed, but it hasn't existed in the way that it does currently before the late 20th century in the notice, both these cases are drug cases. It's not a surprise in the war on drugs. As part of that process and trying to fund these activities. And it's a fundamentally different thing. And you have to, and so both Justice Gorsuch's concurrence and Justice Sotomayor's dissent are wrestling with what is actually going on. Because this is different than your ordinary use of historical interpretation. Because it's just not very informative as the right. government has expanded its use of civil asset forfeiture. So anyway, very interesting case, which brings us to our second case, Cosby versus Erie from episode 184. And this deals with Indiana procedure with respect to directed verdicts. And the question was whether the court is allowed to undertake a evaluation of the credibility of witnesses in its both a qualitative as well as a quantitative analysis of witnesses and take the case away from the jury. And the court says, no, you can't evaluate jury credibility if there's a quantum of evidence sufficient to meet the plaintiff's burden of moving forward. You have to let the case go to the jury. And then you can say that verdict was unreasonable at the end of the case. Because if you then appeal it, you've then got a verdict to reinstate should the plaintiff win. In this case, the trial court took the case entirely away from the jury before it got to the jury, entered judgment in favor of the defendants. And so there's no jury to render it back to. And so that's a problem. But there was at least a quantum of evidence with respect to the claims against Erie. So there's two defendants. There's the broker. And there's here, this is an insurance coverage case. And so there was quantum of evidence against Erie that should have allowed the case to go forward. So the case got remanded for the claim against Erie. Whereas the claim against the broker, the court held that there was not sufficient evidence to move forward as to the broker. And so it affirmed the ruling as to the broker. The reason why the black box turned this into a punt was because of the split between what they did, but also because they clarified their procedure in a way that I think was not what had been anticipated was on the menu and how it was going to be applied. So the black box bit out a punt. Maybe it could have been a half win for each something. We said affirm. They kind of affirmed. They kind of reversed. They kind of clarified. They did a lot of things in this opinion. If you practice in Indiana. Civil work in Indiana, you need to read this case. Again, Cosby versus Erie, important, interesting case. Dan, thoughts on that matter?
No, I agree with you. Interesting procedural case. So if you practice in Indiana, you should take a look at it.
And then we have Knott, that's NOTT versus Swedish Covenant. We discussed on episode 197. This came out a month ago and I missed it. I came across it. The lawyer who argued it or prevailed for it over at Johnson & Bell, who won it, posted it, and I didn't see it until this weekend. I was like, oh, I missed that case. I thought, so anyway, this is the case where the CPS teacher is like to look at the children in the bathroom. Dan, tell us what happened.
Yeah, but it's horrible, horrible factual situation. There was a Section 2619 motion. The plaintiff's Third Amendment complaint was dismissed. And there was a settlement with the alleged agent, released the alleged principal from liability based on her conduct. The court said that if there's any claims that remain, the Abuse and Neglected Child Reporting Act and the Mental Health and Development Disabilities Confidentiality Act immunized defendant's conduct, and that there was some additional evidence that was presented by plaintiff that her confidential information was not disclosed. And so, as we've talked about many times on this show, sometimes there's egregious matters and some significant injuries, but not necessarily good remedies for those wrongs. So
when you do what this person did, you don't get much sympathy from the court, I think is the moral of this story.
I agree.
So that brings us to our prediction, sure to go wrong this week, Dan.
Yep.
Andrews versus Carbon, that gets affirmed.
Affirmed.
Dolson versus Vio Wright. I have no clue. None.
I'm a bit skeptical whether a transfer be granted, but I don't know.
That's part of the problem. I don't know what
right.
they're.
And then if I they mean, do, I don't know what they.
If transfer is denied, then they agree with the appellate court in full.
Right.
If they grant transfer, the appellate court goes away, then they modify whatever the appellate court did. I don't know. I have no clue.
I think we had to punt on this one. It's two.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Rousey versus Brightman is a laugher. It's affirmed, but
affirmed.
It's it was. I don't know
and,
why that case got appealed.
And it'll be an interesting to see if there's any good nuggets in the opinion.
Right. Right. We'll see. All right. Which brings us to the rule of the week, Dan. And what? Tell us about that.
Sure. And you found us. It came up. You had posted, and we talked about last week the prior witnesses issue and whether you prep your witnesses based on prior testimony of other witnesses. And we talked about that. And then there was a follow up postings on that post. Lauren Stein, who we've interacted with, you interact probably more with him than I do, but from time to time he posts on our posts, and he said that his understanding is the court clearly but orally ordered the exclusion of witnesses, and that an oral ruling by the court during a trial or hearing is an order, just not a written order, and he cited to Rule 271 that an oral argument, just like motions, the order of the court can be oral as well. And what he references, Rule 271, says when the court rules upon a motion, other than in the course of trial, the attorney for the prevailing party shall prepare and present to the court the order or judgment to be entered, unless the court directs otherwise. And so, the bottom line is that you can have oral orders. I think the best practice for all this stuff, as we've talked about, would be to memorialize it in some kind of written order, but in any event,
usually what you do in a motion in limine context is you'll have your say 25 motions in limine, and you'll have an order prepared with checks at the motion in limine conference, and you'll have order one or motion one, and you'll have columns. You'll have granted, denied, reserved. And
or other, if it's a mix, yeah. I mean, if
some
kind of
judge modifies it, you may have to write that in. That becomes a bit complicated. But
yeah,
you have your thing, and you're hoping it's granted, denied, granted, denied, granted, denied, reserved, whatever.
Right.
Da, da, da.
Then they have a record.
And then you've got that, and then you may have separate order. Then you may have to prepare a separate order as to one where the judge says, "This is what I'm doing," and then you modify that. But that's the object. And that's what I suspect they had. It's unclear if they had that here. So we'll
yeah.
see when the opinion comes out. But I had never come across or dealt with Rule 271. I thought that was interesting that he pointed that out and wanted to bring that to folks' attention, because we deal with a lot of Supreme Court rules. And this was one that was new to me. So although it's certainly the way things are practiced, I just took it for granted and didn't realize there was a rule on it. So
yeah,
interesting. So with that, we'll take our leave. I appreciate everybody joining us this week. We'll see you next week on the Podium and Panel Podcast.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the Podium and Panel. Each episode on the Podium and Panel Podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship. Information on previous case results do not guarantee a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.